Yeah, thank you very much. I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to this interesting conference, and I hope to give you some inspirational exposure to quantum physics, where KPZ scaling is important. It's about, on one hand, behavior under magnetic field of localized electrons, but also localized bosons as opposed to fermions, and I'll emphasize a lot the role of exchange statistics. And we will see that actually for bosons, localized bosons have a close relationship to directed polymers, where the KPZ scaling comes out very clearly. For fermions, we will see that it also comes out, but it's much less understood why, and that's maybe an open challenge for you. These are the students who did most of the work that I'm talking about. So the talk has several aims. One is finding traces of Cardo Parisi-Zhang in disordered quantum systems, and in particular to understand the structure of quantum wave functions in localized regimes in a disorder potential. We'll show you the amazing robustness of KPZ universality if you are in two dimensions. And as I said, we want to understand the effect of quantum statistics in localized systems. You can ask, well, if I have very localized particles that do not roam around and diffuse, and essentially they never exchange, why does it matter whether I look at fermions or bosons? We'll see it does matter and can be probed by magnetic fields. Okay, and then I show you a few experiments where potentially you can see KPZ. Okay, so what are localized quantum particles? There's a standard, very old model by Phil Anderson of single particles hopping in a random potential, hopping from side to side, and on each side you have a random potential. So this is a quadratic Hamiltonian that's just a random matrix, if you wish, as a mathematician, and you ask about the eigenfunctions of this Hamiltonian or the eigenvectors. And what you find is when the disorder here is large, that means it is very rare that this hopping can bridge the energy disparity between neighboring sides, then the eigenfunctions look very trivial. It's almost sitting on certain sides, and only rarely you hybridize two neighboring sides, and you get strongly localized wave functions. And only when you reduce the disorder and you get more and more hybridizations like that, you get delocalized wave functions, and in the extreme limit of no disorder, you get plane waves, and that's when the transition to the metal happens. But we will be interested in this limit where we have strong localization, and we will ask how does a wave function look like when we go far away from the center of localization, and that's where we will see KPZ physics. Okay, so as you increase disorder, and if you look at eigenfunctions at various energies, in general, you will localize only in the band edges where the density of states is low, because then you have little chance to hybridize well. But if you increase the disorder in this direction, at some point when you're on a lattice, you will localize all states, and that's the situation that we are going to discuss. Now, how do wave functions look like? This is relatively close to the delocalization transition, but you see that wave functions look very complicated. They have a strong rugged structure in space, and there's strong inhomogeneity, and that means that somehow the spatial decay of the wave function is not just diffusive, homogeneous in all directions, but that optimal disorder paths are dominating certain directions, and that the decay is not at all uniform. Now, there's a close connection with directed polymer physics, and roughly you can think of directed polymer, well, the direction of growth of the directed polymer would be the direction radial from the center of localization of a quantum particle here, and the height function, or the free energy of the directed polymer, would be the logarithm of the wave function squared of the probability of finding the particle at some point. Okay. Now, what I showed you up to now was the Anderson model, which is just a single particle problem, just a quadratic matrix. But you can also ask about localization in many particle systems. So if you talk about bosons, then you have in mind that there are many bosons in a thermodynamic system. There's a random potential, and the bosons need some repulsion. And then you can still talk about localization, and you think about the ground state, and you look at excitations above the ground state, and you ask, how do these excitations differ from the ground state? So how do you see an excited boson propagating above the ground state? And you will see that if you're in a strongly disordered regime, then there is an excitation that is more or less localized in some place, and then there's an exponential decay as you go away from the localization center. Okay? So examples of that would be localized spin waves in disordered magnets, or excitations in so-called Bose classes, which also are known under the term dirty bosons. And now it's interesting to ask, how are dirty bosons different from dirty fermions? Are they just the same because they basically never exchange, or do you see something? And you do see something interesting if you look at fermions versus bosons. So that's the first thing I want to tell you. So where do you see dirty bosons in experiments? There are certain superconductors where you have preformation of Cooper pairs. Cooper pairs are bosons. They have different exchange statistics from fermions. When you exchange two bosons, you don't get the minus sign as opposed to fermions. If you look at Josephson junction arrays of superconducting islands, that's also basically bosons, because Cooper pairs that tunnel from one island to the other are bosons. And of course, now we have cold atoms with bosonic atoms in there. That's also a bosonic system. And of course, disordered spin systems are also bosonic systems. So in all those, you can ask about localization properties. Now I want to discuss how you see effects of exchange statistics. How do you see whether you deal with a fermionic localized system or a bosonic localized system? And the only difference, if we are restricting ourselves to hardcore bosons, that are bosons on a lattice that can just not sit on the same side, but otherwise have no interactions, how do such hardcore bosons differ from hardcore fermions? Hardcore fermions are just free fermions without interactions, and the only difference between the two cases is that the phase that you get when you exchange two particles. So that's a neat theoretical setting where you can understand something interesting. So what I want to consider is a Hamiltonian where you have basically the Anderson Hamiltonian for fermions. Here you have the disorder potential, you have the hopping from between nearest neighbor sites. N is just the occupation number, so that's a B dagger B. For the mathematicians, B dagger means I create a particle at the site I, and B means I destroy a particle at the site I, and I act on the Fock space for fermions of antisymmetric wave functions. And of course, there can only be zero or one particle on a given site. These are spinless fermions. And for bosons, I would act on the Fock space of fully symmetric wave functions. And if I have hardcore bosons, it means again that there is only zero or one particle per site. Okay, and the only difference is in the commutation relations. For fermions, you have this anti-commutation relations, which encapsulate that when you exchange fermions, you get the minus sign. And for hardcore bosons, they behave basically like spin 1/2 particles. There you usually have to be interested in the commutator of two of an creation and an annihilation operator, and what you get here is not the delta ij. They commute on different sides, but when they are on the same side, you not only get the delta ij, but you get a minus or a plus sign depending on whether the site is already occupied or empty. Okay, and it's this sign that plays a crucial role when we discuss localization. Okay, so how can you get hardcore bosons? One simple case is when you have preformed pairs in superconductors where you form Cooper pairs locally, and these pairs hop around. So these pairs are hardcore bosons, for example. Now, how do you characterize localization in such a disordered system? What you want is that you make a local excitation, for example, here, and you want to describe how the excitation looks different from the ground state, and typically the perturbation that you introduce will decay exponentially with distance, and it will decay on a typical scale, which is called the localization length. So you would want to characterize that. And why is that important? That will show up in transport. If you pass current through a disordered electronic system or a bosonic system, the resistance will be exponentially large because it's very difficult to make such localized particles move if you apply an electric field. But there is going to be transport if you scatter inelastically from phonons, and the localization length appears in the resistance in the exponent. The details are not important, it's just important to know that this is actually an observable quantity in some sense. If you do not have phonons, then you will not see this kind of behavior, but then you can ask questions about transmission with leads. So here would now be your sample that is disordered, for example, the Anderson model. And here you have leads, and you apply a certain voltage, and then you ask how much current is flowing through this situation. So if there are no phonons to help you, then you just have a single particle problem, and the transmission from here to here is basically exponentially small in this distance with a decay rate that is given by its localization length. Okay. There's another way of getting transport, that is if you have actually a mobility edge. If not all states are localized, but if at some energy higher up there is and you have delocalized states, then you can have good transport by activating to the mobility edge. And this kind of transport I will discuss in the very end. And that is also sensitive to the behavior of the localization length as a function of energy. Okay, so these are three manifestations of this localization length. And now we want to understand how it is depending on magnetic field or depending on the exchange statistics. Okay, good. So how does one compute something like this? The localization length is essentially given by the average exponential decay of a Green's function. So what you do is you put the particle on a side zero, and then you ask after some time t, do I see the perturbation that I made at side zero at the side I? And you expect that the perturbation is exponentially small in this distance between zero and I. And you ask in frequency space after Fourier transform how this Green's function decays with distance. For bosons, you do exactly the same. Instead of the anti-commutator, you just take the commutator. And the localization length is just the limit of the logarithmic decay, the logarithm of this Green's function in the long distance limit. How this Green's function decays in general. That's real. That would be a real time. Yeah, but you go to frequencies, so you probe a certain excitation of a frequency omega, and then you ask how does this decay in real space. Now for fermions, for non-interacting particles, we know that this localization length nearly doesn't depend on which energy you are probing unless you're really in the band edges. But we'll see that for bosons this is very different, and that's an interesting feature of the exchange statistics. Okay, so now how do you go about this? And now we get closer to making a connection with directed polymers, okay? So how do you compute this Green's function? You cannot do this exactly, but you can write down an equation of motion for this Green's function. So you write down d by dt of this Green's function minus epsilon, that's the local energy on the last side. and you just plug in, you use the Hamiltonian to evaluate that, and you find for fermions exactly this recursion relation between this Green's function and the Green's function to a neighboring site. Okay? And what I use here in evaluating that are the commutation or anti-commutation relations. Okay? Now you iterate this recursion relation and you take a Fourier transform as well to go to frequency space, and then you see that the Green's function can formally be expressed as a sum over all paths to go from 0 to I. You see you have this Green's function from 0 to I is expressed as a Green's function from 0 to J, and J is one site next to I. So formally you can write that the Green's function ratio with the local Green's function is just a sum over all possible paths to go from 0 to I of some product of locators. So these locators are nothing else than the inverse of this factor in frequency space. Okay, and here you have the hopping T. Right. Now, if the hopping, this matrix element here is very small, that means that you're strongly localized, that you're not hybridizing well. And that's the regime where the wave functions are strongly decaying in space. So if this factor is very small, then you have an interest to go as quickly as possible from 0 to I, and you will only sum over the shortest path and not take detours. But if 0 and I are, for example, along a diagonal of a square lattice, then you have still exponentially many paths to go from here to here. So this is a non-trivial problem here, even if you restrict to the so-called forward scattering paths, where you only take the shortest path, right? Now, this is an old problem that was formulated first by Spivak, Shklovsky, and Wen over 30 years ago, and it was had a lot of beautiful physics in there. In particular, you see that you have an interesting interference of many paths that lead from 0 to I. So for each path, you have an amplitude that looks a bit like, you know, it's a product of a lot of local terms. So this looks like a term in a partition function. And so this looks actually, the whole thing looks like a partition sum. With the difference that the terms here are not positive definite, as in statistical physics, but they have sometimes positive, sometimes negative signs. Right. So now you want to see the effect of this interference here, and you probe that usually by piercing now a magnetic field through this two-dimensional system. What does a magnetic field do? It gives a phase to these hoppings. Magnetic field has an Aronoff-Bohm phase associated to it, and so whether you go this way or that way will not just be T squared, but it comes with a phase, and the strength of this phase is controlled by the magnetic field, and that disturbs this interference over here. And the main effect, as Spivak, Shklovsky, and Wen had understood back then, was for this field to destroy the negative interference of certain paths that had essentially the same amplitude but an opposite sign. So the strongest effect of the magnetic field is to kill negative interference, and that makes this interference sum bigger. And so that means that the Green's function increases when you apply a magnetic field. That's called negative magnetoresistance. So the localization lengths accordingly will increase because you get further away in space, and the resistance that you see in an experiment will decrease, negative magnetoresistance. Now we do the same thing for bosons, and we'll see exactly the opposite will come out. That's interesting. No. So if you write down the equation of motion for the bosonic Green's function, you use the Hamiltonian to evaluate that, then you get now here a slightly non-trivial term. You get the phase, a minus sign, depending on whether the site is occupied at site I or not. Okay, and now this is only approximately to lowest order in the hopping. You can evaluate this in the following way. Again, relating one Green's function to another Green's function, which is one side closer. Okay, but if you're interested in the leading term in the hopping, then this is exact. So there will be corrections that are higher order in the hopping. And the only difference with respect to the fermion problem is this sign factor here. Okay, so it looks pretty innocent at first sight. So again, to the approximation where you work in the leading order in hopping, that means shortest path and no corrections here, you get the following partition sum, basically. Sum over all shortest paths of this expression. And the only thing that is different between bosons and fermions is this sign here. That looks innocent and almost trivially the same, but it's not. If you go to zero frequency excitations, that means very low energy excitations above the ground state, then you see that this factor here is now always positive, right? The omega is zero, then you get 1 over modulus epsilon. Previously, for fermions, 1 over epsilon was sometimes positive, sometimes negative. Here, it's always positive. And now you see that the sum becomes a sum of positive terms, and so it becomes like a partition function. So this now actually looks exactly like the partition function of a directed polymer that grows from here to here with Boltzmann weights, which are just this T over absolute value of epsilon. And now this establishes a very close connection to the directed polymer problem, and it should not be a surprise that you will see KPZ somewhere. Okay, and now we will explore where you see that KPZ in the physics. Okay, so to understand the sign here, that's relatively simple for physicists to understand. If you take two paths and you actually ask what you do when you compute this Green's function, you put in a particle here and you take it out there. But there are already many particles in the system. It's a many-body problem. So what you actually ask for is when you put the particle in here and you want to take it out here, it's not the same particle that you take out, but you basically have to move the other particles one slot further. So you're basically shifting all particles by one slot. Now, if you take two paths and you form a loop, and you take one path forward, in time and the other backward in time, you have a ring exchange. And the sign of the ring exchange differs between fermions and bosons if you have an odd number of particles on your loop. And this product of signs here just tells you whether you have an odd or an even number of particles on the loop, because a negative sign means that in the ground state you will have a boson, right? So now you see, actually, for bosons, this problem becomes much nicer or more manageable because you have positive weights, and that's something we can deal with. For fermions, you have these random signs, and it's not obvious that you should get KPZ scaling out. Now let's ask what happens when now you apply a magnetic field to the bosons. Previously, I told you that you destroy negative interference of certain terms here. Now all the terms are coming with a positive amplitude, and now if you add phases to these amplitudes, then not all terms are aligned anymore, but they get random phases, and that will necessarily decrease the sum and not increase it. So you get exactly the opposite effect on the localization lengths. The psi will decrease, the wave function will shrink, and the resistance of the bosons will increase. So bosons and fermions react very oppositely to the magnetic field. And that effect is seen in experiments. Here is an experiment on superconductors, which was conjectured to have actually local Cooper pairs, so local bosons. And what you see is the change in resistance as a function of field here, and the fact that the resistance goes up and not down as you put magnetic field. It's a smoking gun for the presence of bosons as carriers. Good. Okay. Now you can ask, how strong is this effect? So you can look at the change of the logarithm of the Green's function at a large distance for bosons and for fermions. At large distance, the change of the logarithm will be extensive, so it will be proportional to the distance. And the change is just actually the change of the inverse localization length, by definition. And now you see that for bosons, the effect, look at the scale here, the effect is much bigger than for fermions. So for fermions, this destruction of occasional negative interference is a very subtle and very weak effect. But for bosons, you get an extremely strong effect, which is about 7 times bigger for the inverse localization length. And that means experimentally, since this appears in an exponent, this means a very strong magnetoresistance. And indeed, it is conjectured that this physics is actually relevant for certain insulators that turn from bosonic carriers to fermionic carriers. And accordingly, the resistance as a function of magnetic field is first going up, there where you still have preformed pairs. And then it goes down once you have destroyed the pairs and you have electronic transport. Now I want to show you actually the physical manifestation of KPZ physics. So we want to make really use of this mapping to the directed polymer and say something more quantitatively on the localization length as a function of magnetic field. So let us think of a Green's function between I and J, and that this Green's function is essentially mapping the wave function or the shape of the excitation as a function of the endpoint if I is the center of the excitation. Okay, so I'm looking at actually I and zero here maybe. So I look at this Green's function normalized by the local Green's function, and we know that in the small hopping regime this is just the sum over the shortest path. And if you are on this diagonal, there are many paths that contribute here. And that looks, as I said, like a partition. Oops, what is that? What? Sorry about that. What is this? So, yeah, okay. So this looks like a partition function of a directed polymer. And as I said, if you have bosons and the sign factor is present and you go to low energies, it looks exactly like the partition function. But for fermions, for example, this sign is not here and you have random signs in these denominators. And now what you want to understand is how these different terms interfere with each other, right? And so there will be some good paths and some subdominant good paths, and they form certain loops with each other. And you can ask, how do these loops react to a magnetic field that you apply? And that will give you an understanding of the magnetoresistance. But before we do so, let us first discuss weak magnetic fields and weak disorder. And let us define this ratio of the Green's function, which is the essential part of the wave function that decays. Okay, so this is a sum over all shortest paths. And there is a phase that you pick up in the magnetic field. And there is this term that is just the product of locators with this sign. Okay? And the phase is just the Aronoff-Bohm phase along the path. I've never had this problem, but maybe I should not use my think it's the laser pointer that creates this. Okay. So, no, I don't have a copy right now. Yeah, maybe it's the interface. Yeah, I don't even know how to do that. Vehicle. Yeah. Okay.
Is the PowerPoint crashing?
Yeah, it keeps on crashing.
Do you want to switch it to a different machine?
So let me try it once again. I'll just go to the same slide.
Yeah.
Let's go further.
Past the slide?
Yeah. Keep on going. Okay, so maybe have another go or.
Oh, I hate PowerPoint.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, sorry about that. I hope it's now stable. Okay. Right. So, now for this object, this reduced Green's function, you can write a simple recursion relation at zero frequency. And it looks basically like the recursion relation that you would write for the partition function of a directed polymer. But the difference is that you have factors here that have potentially a sign, and you have phases. And if you now take continuum limit, then you get something that looks like a KPZ equation. But here you have covariant derivatives, which means that you have an imaginary potential here, vector potential that comes in. And if you go to the so-called Landau gauge, you see that you get something that looks like the KPZ equation, but here you have a B-dependent complex term. That means you get a complex KPZ equation, which is potentially amenable to field theoretic treatment, and that would be interesting to understand. But I'm not following that route now, but I just give you a qualitative understanding of what a B field actually does to the localization length and how it senses directed polymer physics. So The important thing to understand about these paths that go from I to J is that they are disorder dominated. So at large scale, it's not just the meandering, the diffusive aspect of this path that is important, but the paths will search for the optimal disorder, and they have a roughness that goes like this length scale to the exponent 2/3, as you all know very well, I guess. And that means that loops formed by dominant paths are enclosing an area which is not just L to the 3 house, but L to the 5/3. And now if you pierce the magnetic field, so then you modify the interference of these loops. And so the interesting length scale for a given magnetic field will be when the flux, the magnetic flux through such a loop is of order 1, and that sets a length scale, which is the magnetic length, which is b to the minus this exponent here. Okay? And now you have to ask, how many loops do you have where there are two paths that have a significant amplitude such that they can interfere, and such that when you apply the magnetic field B, will lead to a significant change of the interference. So you have to ask, what is the Green's function contribution due to this kind of path, and the Green's function contribution due to the dominant path that goes another way of the another side of the loop. This will, in directed polymer language, be exponential of the free energy difference between this and that branch. And that scales, as you know, with the energy exponent, which is L to the 1/3. And so the probability that two such paths will really interfere significantly is just LB to the minus theta, which is 1/3. And now you can ask, how many loops do I have where I have significant interference? And per significant loop, I will change the localization length by something of order, or the Green's function by something of order 1. So I just ask, how many loops do I have in total, and what is the probability of having a loop? And that gives me a certain power law as a function of magnetic field, and then there are sub-leading corrections where you have collision of two important loops where you have interference. And so you get the final prediction, which is relatively simple, but reflects KPZ physics, that the change of the inverse localization length is actually B to some non-trivial power, which knows about the energy and the roughness exponent, and turns out to be 4/5. With corrections which are relatively come with a small exponent, so it's relatively difficult to extract that exponent from simulations. And if you want, you can build a toy model and establish that correctly, but it would be more interesting to get that out from the complex KPZ equation directly. Okay, now we have seen how interestingly you get an insight into the structure of the quantum wave functions in 2D, and how KPZ scaling is reflected in magnetoresistance. Now I want to discuss something else where you also see KPZ scaling, where you don't have a magnetic field necessarily, and that's this phononless conduction. So if you make an experiment where you have leads and then you have this disordered sample here, the transmission on this side will roughly be exponential of minus the length times 2 over the localization length. That's just the amplitude squared of a wave function that is roughly 1 here and then decays exponentially, right? And so the localization length can be defined essentially as 2L divided by the average of the log of this transmission. Okay? Now, this transmission is, or the conductance, is a random quantity because the sample is random, and then you can ask, how does this log of G actually vary from sample to sample? So you have, on average, this term, and then you have something fluctuating. And this fluctuation turns out to be closely related to the fluctuations of the free energy of a directed polymer. In particular, you find that the fluctuations go with an exponent of the length that is the energy exponent of directed polymers in general, in all dimensions. So in two dimensions, this will be a 1/3 exponent. But in three dimensions, where this is a cube, say, you will find the energy exponent of 1 plus 2-dimensional directed polymers. And that's old work by Somoza, Ortuño, and also Montes and Garel. Now, in two dimensions, it's more interesting because there we get the directed polymer in 1 plus 1, where we know a lot of things. And it turns out that this fluctuating quantity here is actually Tracy Widom distributed. And there's an amazing robustness of this Tracy Widom law. So apparently, it holds in the presence of negative weights in this partition sum. That means when you are with bosons at finite energies, if omega is not zero, then you have negative weights. But certainly for fermions, it even holds with complex weights, so when you have a magnetic field. And it also holds, apparently, if you don't restrict yourself to the forward scattering approximation, where you only take the shortest path, but if you even allow for loops. So even if you are closer to the metal insulator transition and you include the whole Anderson problem, which has loops in it, then you still find numerically this Tracy Widom scaling. And that's quite amazing. And the only thing that these ingredients here change is that they change the value of psi here. But once you know psi, it seems that everything else is fixed. There's also one constant here, this alpha, which might depend on what you have here. But empirically, it doesn't vary very much from one case to the other. And that's very, very surprising, because the conductance, the average conductance, follows a size dependence given by the renormalization group, which usually cares about whether you have complex weights or real weights. So the universality class in terms of localization physics is definitely different from here to here. And this beta function will be different. And if you take the Tracy Widom law seriously and you compute this beta function, in principle, you expect to find something different from here to here. The only source of this difference should, in principle, be this prefactor here. And that I think that deserves more study and maybe some more thorough theoretical investigation as to why you actually find this Tracy Widom law and why it is so universal. So the only thing that the Tracy Widom law actually seems to care about is the geometrical boundary conditions. So if you take leads that are point contacts and you allow the full space to be explored, then you find the probability distribution of that fluctuating quantity to be the F2 function. Whereas if you take broad, wide leads like this, then like in the directed polymer case, essentially you find the F0 function. And thirdly, if you have point contacts and only a half plane at your disposal, you find the F4. And that's very much the same as what you find for the fluctuations of the free energy in the directed polymer problem if you constrain the space in that way. But why this all works with negative weights and complex weights is an open problem. Now, to conclude, I want to quickly discuss energy dependence and then make some connection with experiments, and then we'll conclude. So I told you in the beginning that the localization length for fermions is very weakly dependent on the energy that you probe, as long as you're not in the band edge. And that is because when you shift this omega, as long as the epsilons are widely distributed, you don't really care whether omega is zero or a bit positive or a bit negative. But here, it does matter whether you look at omega equals zero or at omega positive. So if you have a positive energy excitation or a nearly zero excitation, because as soon as you make omega positive, sometimes you can have negative weights, and that diminishes this interference sum. And so for a bosonic localization, problem. You find that the localization length is actually the largest when omega is very small, if the excitation is very low energy. And as you go higher in energy, you localize more and more because you have more and more destructive interference from that term. Okay, so you come to the conclusion that actually a bosonic problem is most delocalized when you make low energy excitations. And actually something like this is well known from easing magnets. So far we were talking about hardcore bosons, which are rather XY universality class. If you do the locator analysis as I did for the XY problem, you get slightly different locator. And if you go to higher orders, you actually find that the localization length is not only weakly maximal at small frequencies, but has actually a logarithmic singularity like this, which is due to the easing symmetry. So symmetry also matters. Now you might come to the conclusion that bosonic localization is strongest at high energy, and as you go to low energy, it becomes more delocalized, and as you drive to less disorder, you will delocalize at lowest energy first. But that neglects actually that in reality you will have an extra ingredient in physics, and that is long-range Coulomb interactions. And when you ask what Coulomb interactions do in a localized phase, they produce effective local potentials that are not flat distributed, but there is a so-called Evers-Klofsky Coulomb gap, and that means that energies that are close to the chemical potential are suppressed because of these long-range interactions. And that means that you cannot easily hybridize wave functions or excitations that live at this energy because you have few sites that you can resonate with. So it's easier to resonate when you are at a higher energy. And so this is an effect that goes against what I just told you. So when you don't have this term, we found previously that the localization length was maximal when the energy was zero. But if you put back in that term, then you have the opposite effect, actually. And if you apply a magnetic field, then you see that the localization length changes. That is the same as we had before. But the important thing is that now zero energy is a minimum of the localization length. And that means that when you are now driving the system towards less and less disorder, at some point you will have, since the localization length increases as you go here, at some point you may have a mobility edge where the localization length actually diverges. When this term becomes zero, this can happen at the finite energy. And that's called a mobility edge. And if you have a mobility edge and you have no phonons in your system, then you can have transports through excitations at this mobility edge. And what you now can ask is, what does this mobility edge do as a function of magnetic field? And of course, it will oscillate as a function of the flux through your plaquette. Right, you see? As you apply a magnetic field, the mobility edge is going up and down in energy. And now if you have no phonons, you have transport at the mobility edge and you apply a magnetic field, well, you will see a resistance that tells you how much you have to excite a particle to the mobility edge, but that excitation energy will oscillate as a function of field. And so you expect actually quite a large effect of this excitation energy as a function of field, which is periodic in the flux per plaquette that you have. And the important thing is that it goes up and not down first as a function of flux. Okay. And something like this was indeed seen in the experiments with those perforated films, that as a function of flux through these holes that they put into the film, they saw an activation energy in transport that indeed has a behavior like this. And an important hallmark are these cusps here, which were a riddle in the experiments, this kind of cuspy behavior. And that you understand if you believe the KPZ scaling that I explained to you, because here the change of the mobility edge would again reflect this 4/5 exponent that comes from KPZ physics and means that there is non-analytic behavior at those special points where you have zero flux, half flux, one flux, three halves. And if you have doubts that you are dealing with bosons, not fermions, you can compare the theory to fermions. For fermions, you would also see an oscillation of the mobility edge. But first of all, it would start with the opposite, with a downturn, not with an upturn. And the period would be doubled, actually. That is an effect of random signs. And so the fact that experiments show you this kind of behavior is really a smoking gun of bosons present there. And with that, I would like to conclude. So the important message is that the tails of wave functions of localized quantum systems exhibit KPZ physics because essentially the radial direction maps into the growth direction of a directed polymer, even though you have negative or even complex weights. And the Tracy-Witten distribution of the amplitudes at large distance seems amazingly robust to all these changes in the partition function. The localization of bosons shrinks in a magnetic field because you destroy positive interference. So bosons at zero energy are essentially directed polymers. But when you apply a B field, then the positive sum, the sum of positive terms becomes the sum of complex terms, and that makes the sum smaller. And that means the bosons shrink. Fermions become slightly less confined because you destroy negative interference. Right, and in the presence of a Coulomb gap, you have interesting oscillations of the mobility edge, which may relate to actual experiments. That I thank you for your attention.
Are there any questions or comments?
Well, thank you for the nice talk. I have a question about the last part. Mm-hmm. So how did you exactly include these the Coulomb interactions? Did you still use this forward scattering, but then with Coulomb interactions somewhere?
Yeah, so this was a simple two-step approach, which is, of course, only approximate, where you basically only solve this classical problem. You find a ground state or a metastable state of this Hamiltonian, and then you say, if I freeze the occupations on all sides, I get effective side energies, which are given by that. And now I do the forward approximation, plugging in the distribution of such energies.
Thank you for the talk. So I have a question about the relation with the directed polymer problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the directed polymer problem, we know that the partition sum is in the end dominated by a few paths. Is that something similar in the quantum case? Or?
Yes. And then that's the whole important message that you see if you look at wave functions pictures like, I guess, here, right? So if you ask how do I get out here, then you see that there's not a broad wave going out there. There are somehow certain dominant paths that lead to this point, and that reflects directly that the Feynman sum over all paths is dominated by certain trajectories that go through the high peaks.
Because if it's dominated by more or less a single pass, then the sign does not matter, right?
Yeah, that's right. But of course, it's not a single pass. It is always a few paths. And the probability that on a certain scale you have a secondary pass that is nearly as good goes like 1 over that scale to the 1/3. So with L to the 1/3, L to the minus 1/3 probability, you have two paths that that go to the same point. And now if you come with a magnetic field, then you will destroy that interference that you have there. No? And that's why you see that non-trivial power law in the magnetoresistance.
Question. So this interference effect you mentioned, how robust is it against the thermal noise, maybe from the phonons? And what temperature do you have to, how low temperature do you have to do the experiment to observe it?
Yeah, that's a good question. So localization physics is only relevant when you are at low temperatures, such that so what happens in transport is you have a certain you have a particle sitting here, and it should go over here, and that so you have a wave function here, a wave function here, and then it comes a phonon, and that allows you to inelastically scatter, and that will probe the wave function overlap. Now, if temperature is too high, then you can allow yourself to make high energy excitations, and the wave functions are very close, and then they don't care about this tail. So you have to be in a regime where you really go to so large distances that you're sensitive to the tails. And well, this is a simple calculation about level spacing and so on. But that is definitely reached in experiments. It's a very standard regime.
In KPZ, you said you have a disorder is like correlated point-wise, delta correlated. How can you see it from here just by looking at this effective Boltzmann weight?
Yeah, so that effective Boltzmann weight is just this so-called locator. Where is it? Here, right? So it's just this thing, and then that sits on a certain point in space. So this is delta correlated as well, right? So this is supposed to be a random energy that depends on both coordinates, radial and angular. So it's just not exponential minus v, but it is 1 over epsilon. So the large tails are a bit fatter, but that's not relevant for the KPZ scaling. I think you would need something much fatter than that to change the behavior. So this is also delta correlated, to answer your question.
Let me also ask a question. So you had that slide about the robustness of trace Sivinum layer. You consider negative weights, complex weights, etc. Mm-hmm. So is it more like heuristic observation, or do you have some kind of proof in this direction? So.
Well, what I showed is the work of essentially Miguel Ortuño and collaborators, and he gave a more extensive talk on that early in the program, I understand. And largely it's heuristic, but there are some arguments by Mehran Karda and Medina that say if you have at least the random sign problem, and you have, say, with equal probability, positive or negative sign in this thing, then you can look at moments of this Green's function, and you can ask yourself, when I disorder average the moments, what do I have to do? So how do you calculate moments? You take copies of your system and you average, and then you see that you always need at least you need an even number of copies on a given link or on a given node, and then you argue that basically you have for the moment 2n, you have 2n particles where always two particles have to be together, and so you have pairs of particles that are wandering from I to J, and if they encounter, then you can exchange one particle with the of the pair, and you have three choices to do that, and that gives you an entropic attraction of these pairs, and then you can say that the pairs in that problem are actually attracting to each other. That's like when you replicate the positive weight problem, then you also see an attraction. And you can say on the level of pairs, you have again the same problem as before, and therefore this might be in the same universality class. But beyond that, there is nothing, I guess. And that's why it's interesting.
Any other questions?
This forward scattering approximation, I was wondering if there's any parallel work in mathematics, perhaps, because it seems to be equivalent to replacing the Anderson model, which I think what mathematicians call the parabolic Anderson model, which is to say doesn't only involves like a first derivative term in that direction you're going along. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you knew of any work where people had tried to establish this at the equivalence at a more mathematical level.
No, I don't know. I doubt, but I don't know.
Okay, let's thank our speaker again. Thank you.